Welcome to the Bulletin History Podcast, presented by the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. JMC's mission is to provide conventional munitions for all U.S. military services. The mission of this podcast is to tell the story of that effort, providing critical information about munitions, the installations that produced them, and the wide range of communities that hosted or continue to host those installations. JMC currently operates or coordinates with 17 arsenals, depots, and ammunition plants around the country, but hundreds of installations have contributed to the ammunition mission over the past 2.5 centuries. The goal of the Bulletin History Podcast is to tell their stories. We're not sure we can cover them all, but let's give it a try. We thank you for coming along for the ride. For our first episode, we'd like to tell one of many stories centered on the community that is home to our headquarters. JMC is located on the Rock Island Arsenal, a government-owned 946-acre island in the Mississippi River between Rock Island, Illinois, and Davenport, Iowa. Though widely known as the Quad Cities, the area is concentrated around 5 cities, Davenport and Bettendorf in Iowa, and Rock Island, Moline, and East Moline in Illinois. These are just the largest of a staggering 63 communities in the metro area, the largest of which numbers over 100,000 residents, while the smallest has just 19. As of the 2020 census, the Quad Cities region had a population of more than 384,000 people, making it the largest metro area on the Mississippi River between Minneapolis and St. Louis. The Rock Island Arsenal was officially founded by President Abraham Lincoln on July 11, 1862. But the federal government first became aware of the area during the War of 1812, during which 2 naval battles took place in the area. Federal interest led to the establishment of Fort Armstrong on the west end of the island in 1816, both to help patrol river traffic and contain native unrest, like that which boiled over in 1832 during the Black Hawk War. This is just a hint of the rich history shared by the Rock Island Arsenal and the Quad Cities region. Many aspects of this history are worth discussing, and we will undoubtedly explore them in the future. For now, we'd like to focus on a story which involved the community, the military, and the United States as a whole. If you asked Quad City residents to name aspects of local history which they find the most interesting or unique, you'd get a variety of answers. Over the past 2 centuries, the community has been home to Native American leader Black Hawk, jazz musician Bix Beiderbecke, artist Isabel Bloom, frontiersman Buffalo Bill, Ronald Reagan in his early days on radio, and numerous nationally known athletes. Today, the area is home to the Arsenal, John Deere headquarters, important regional hospitals, minor league sports teams, casinos, music and arts festivals, and a PGA tournament. In the past, the Quad Cities was a stop on Charles Lindbergh's first transcontinental flight, hosted the first professional football team to hire an African-American player, and subject of this episode was the location of the first railroad bridge to span the Mississippi River. Credit for the first bridge of any kind to cross the Mississippi River goes to the city of Minneapolis, which completed a pedestrian bridge in 1855, 1 year before the Rock Island Railroad Bridge opened. The current swing span bridge, crossing from the island to the Iowa shore, referred to by locals as the Government Bridge or Arsenal Bridge, can frankly be a bit of a nuisance during warm weather months when the span opens for barge traffic frequently throughout the day, bringing both rail and vehicular traffic to a halt. This bridge dates from 1898, but is actually the 4th bridge at or near its present location. The first bridge was not easy or cheap to build, and courted controversy that aroused the anger of people throughout the country. In fact, frustration over this bridge is nothing new. Such sentiments have been there all along. The story of the first bridge dates from late June 1845, when prominent local resident Colonel George Davenport hosted a meeting at his home on Rock Island, site of the future Rock Island Arsenal. Colonel Davenport was well known in the area. The English-born man had served in the British Navy before joining the U.S. Army. Settling on Rock Island, he served in turn as Indian agent, merchant, army sutler, and land speculator. In attendance at the colonel's meeting were other community leaders, including Antoine Leclerc, founder of the city of Davenport, which he named for his friend, and Judge James Grant, a respected railroad lawyer. The subject of the meeting was Davenport's plan to build a railroad to Rock Island with the goal of bridging the Mississippi River into Davenport. The meeting adjourned with the attendees in agreement to proceed with the plan. Colonel Davenport unfortunately didn't live to see this plan come to fruition. 2 weeks after the meeting, bandits broke into his house and murdered him. We'll return to that story in a future episode. After Davenport's death, his partners carried his vision forward and, in the process, helped change the future of the United States. If this sounds like hyperbole, consider how important railroads had become by then. In 1830, the entire United States had just 40 miles of rail. 5 years later, there were 800 miles. By 1840, 2,700 miles, and by 1845, 4,600 miles. Spurred in part by the gold rush, the United States would have more than 8,500 miles of track by just 1850. Everyone understood that rail transportation was the key to future U.S. expansion and the settlement of the West. So it should be no surprise that Davenport's partners saw the benefit in building a rail line to Rock Island and beyond. To this end, the Illinois General Assembly granted a charter to the group, establishing their venture as the Rock Island and LaSalle Railroad Company on the 27th of February, 1847. The president of the company was Judge Grant. Other officials included wealthy citizens from Rock Island, Davenport, and Moline. The problem was, none of these directors had ever attempted to build a railroad. So their efforts stalled until Michigan railroad operator Henry Farnham became a partner 2 years later. Farnham convinced his fellow directors to extend the railroad from Chicago rather than LaSalle, thus enabling Farnham to raise capital from investors he knew in that city. Chicago businessmen already thought of their growing city as the next big thing, with railroads as the driving force. Farnham focused on Chicago because it was already a rail hub. He also saw that westward expansion would lead to the creation of a transcontinental railroad, which would prove a boon to the nation. Farnham knew that whatever region built that line would benefit greatly, and he was not alone in this realization. Prominent politicians and businessmen across the country were already maneuvering to make their regions the official right-of-way for the construction of a rail line to California. Northern politicians wanted a San Francisco terminus starting in Chicago. Southern politicians wanted a San Diego terminus starting in New Orleans. This was not just an economic issue. Consideration of the Transcontinental Railroad was tied directly to the ongoing political argument over slavery. Both sides knew that the first region to reach the Pacific Ocean would guide settlement patterns, thus giving it an advantage in the establishment of new states. This would in turn lead either to the expansion or restriction of slavery, depending on whether settlers came from the northern or southern tier of the United States. This fact became particularly true with the Missouri Compromise in 1850. This agreement established a political balance in the Senate by adding Missouri as a slave state and Maine as a free state. At the same time, the compromise made the southern border of Missouri the line dividing future slave and free states. No new state north of that line could have slaves, essentially drawing a dividing line through the West all the way to California. This gave Farnham an extra bargaining chip to use with Chicago's money men. By investing in the Rock Island line, he argued, they were not just establishing a route that terminated at the Mississippi River, and not just investing in the first stage of a transcontinental line. They were sparking the creation of free states in the West, spurring the eventual end of slavery in America. Farnham's lobbying worked. In February 1851, the charter was amended, establishing the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad Company. Construction started in Chicago in October 1851. The new rail line reached Joliet in October 1852, and by the start of 1853, the company had completed one-third of the proposed Illinois route. At the same time, the directors were planning how to accomplish the most difficult step, bridging the Mississippi River. This task would involve three separate railroad companies: the Chicago and Rock Island, building the route across Illinois; the Mississippi and Missouri, building a route across Iowa; and the M&M Bridge Company, connecting the railroads by bridging the river. The M&M Bridge Company included directors from the other two companies, with Henry Farnham serving in all three. On the 17th of January, 1853, the state of Illinois incorporated the bridge company, giving it the right to, quote, construct, maintain, and operate a bridge in such a manner as to leave unobstructed the navigation of the waterway and furnish a connection with all railroads in Illinois and Iowa which might terminate at or near said bridge, unquote. Bridging the river was controversial for several reasons. The first involved the North-South rivalry between both railroad interests and politicians. Political and business interests lined up on either side of the emerging debate over which route was preferable for a transcontinental railroad. Given the sectional hostility in the U.S. Congress, neither side was interested in giving in. Northern politicians did their best to block Southern routes, while Southern politicians worked to block Northern routes. The second issue was the potential impact of railroad bridges on the most important business on the Mississippi River, steamboats. Once it became clear that railroads intended to span the river, steamboat companies, as well as chambers of commerce in critical river towns, resisted, using every means at their disposal to interfere with bridge construction. Steamboats had already begun to see decreased traffic on the Ohio River due to railroad expansion throughout that region. The first span across the Ohio River, a highway suspension bridge opening at Wheeling, West Virginia in 1849, had also diverted some river traffic to roads. Steamboat companies went to court to have the Wheeling Bridge removed as a menace to navigation, but Congress allowed it to remain, citing it as a vital avenue for postal delivery. Although steamboat traffic on the Missouri and Mississippi rivers increased in the early 1850s, rivermen could see the writing on the wall. Steamboats were slow and expensive compared to trains. Railroad bridges would change everything, not just as competition, but as potential physical impediments to the free flow of river traffic. Steamboat companies did not see this as innocent interference, but as calculated attacks upon their industry. The debate soon centered on the issue of rights. Who had the right of way, asked rivermen, established riverboats or upstart railroads? Underpinning this competition was the growing rivalry between two cities with the most at stake: the river metropolis of St. Louis and the rail metropolis of Chicago. During the intensifying debate, Chicago and St. Louis, occasionally joined by New Orleans, drove these arguments, in both the public and in the courts, in support of rail or steamboat interests. As the public became aware of plans for the Rock Island Bridge, prominent citizens and politicians entered the debate, reflecting regional disagreements that would eventually lead to the Civil War. This is especially ironic when you realize that the two most prominent men emerging on either side of the bridge debate were Illinois attorney Abraham Lincoln and Secretary of War Jefferson Davis. Railroad companies had two significant points in their favor. First, water freezes in the north, rendering rivers and canals useless for many months every year. Railroads had no such barrier. Second, boats only operate on the water, while railroads can go virtually anywhere. The river interests could no longer ignore the threat once Henry Farnham incorporated his company and commenced plans for building the bridge, which would happen in three stages: first, from Illinois to the island; second, across the island; and third, from the island to Davenport. As the company began surveying a location for the bridge in 1853, opposition forces moved against the effort, starting a series of court cases that would force other railroad companies to wait before embarking upon similar ventures. No one wanted to risk building bridges if the courts might rule against them. As a result, the Rock Island Bridge became the test case for railroad bridge construction across the country. The first effort to stop the bridge came from Secretary of War Jefferson Davis. Davis wanted a southern route for the Transcontinental Railroad. That's part of the reason he pushed for the Gadsden Purchase in 1853, in which Mexico gave the United States 30,000 square miles of land in southern New Mexico and Arizona, directly on a proposed New Orleans to San Diego route, though Congress would later reject this. Davis knew that the expansion of the Chicago and Rock Island line across the Mississippi River would give the North an advantage in westward expansion. Therefore, pro-slavery Davis sought to restrain northern expansion by stopping the bridge. In his estimation, he had the authority to do so as Secretary of War. The bridge company proposed crossing the island, which Davis argued was federal military property, citing the presence of Fort Armstrong. However, the federal government had abandoned the island in 1832 and made preliminary efforts to sell parcels of it to the public, leading many to believe that it was publicly available land. That included dozens of squatters who had since called the island home, most prominently the late Colonel Davenport. Further confusing things, the Congressional Act of 1852 granted, quote, rights of way to all rail and plank roads or McAdam and Turnpike companies through the public lands of the United States, unquote. Was the island military or government or public or private land? Davis declared the island government-owned military property, but the railroad company called it a congressionally approved right-of-way and started surveying the island in the fall of 1853. Hedging their bets, the bridge company also sent an official request to the War Department asking for permission to build. This was arguably a mistake. By asking permission, the bridge company effectively acknowledged the federal government's claim, thus giving Jefferson Davis an excuse to deny the request. While this argument played itself out, the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad Company completed its route across Illinois, reaching Rock Island on the 22nd of February, 1854. That spring, the first organized rail excursion carried 1,300 travelers across the prairie from Chicago, reportedly stopping to pick wildflowers along the way. Upon reaching Rock Island, the travelers enjoyed the firing of cannons at the depot beneath a giant banner that said, "The Mississippi and the Atlantic shake hands." Ironically, also taking part in the celebration were six of the largest steamboats on the Mississippi, which were docked at Rock Island, bands playing on their upper decks. Following this, Jefferson Davis, using his authority as Secretary of War, declared in April 1854 that the federal government would not grant the bridge company access to the island. Davis likely expected this to end the issue, but Farnham simply ordered his workers to continue construction. Soon, a major change in federal policy forced Davis to take the bridge issue more firmly in hand. In May 1854, Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act. This ended the Missouri Compromise, declaring that any new states, drawn from the territories of Kansas, Nebraska, Utah, or New Mexico, would become slave or free states according to the vote of the people in each state when founded. This meant whichever group settled an area the fastest, meaning pro-slave or anti-slave, would win on the slavery issue. Jefferson Davis realized a Rock Island bridge, as the launching point of a transcontinental route, would funnel settlers from northern states to the west, leading to the creation of free states at a faster rate than slave states, thus shifting the balance of power to the north. To prevent this, Davis sent a U.S. Marshal to Rock Island on July 17, 1854, with orders for the company to cease and desist construction and to remove all structures, equipment, and personnel from the island within 15 days under threat of arrest. By then, the route across the island had been surveyed and graded, with stone abutments and piers already in place on either side of Sylvan Slough, which is the channel between Illinois and the island. Again, the bridge company ignored these orders and continued working. Realizing that his actions were having no effect, and encouraged by river interests in St. Louis and New Orleans, Jefferson Davis filed an injunction in federal court to stop the bridge company from crossing the island and from building a bridge, on the grounds that, one, they were trespassing on federal property, and two, bridges were impediments to free navigation of the river. United States versus the Railroad Bridge Company went before Judge John McLean in July 1855 in the U.S. Circuit Court for Northern Illinois in Chicago. McLean ruled that the War Department had abandoned the island, making the area public land. As public land, the right-of-way permissions in the Act of 1852 applied. In response to concerns about navigation, McLean ruled that there was nothing preventing boats from traveling safely under the proposed bridge. He further concluded that the railroad bridge was of vital public interest and that the state of Illinois had the right to authorize it. Judge McLean denied the injunction, ending Jefferson Davis's efforts to stop bridge construction. The argument over Rock Island was settled for the time being, which is good, because it was a perfect place for a bridge. The shores were bedrock, providing a firm foundation for piers. Also, using the island as a stepping stone would shorten the required length of the main channel bridge, making construction easier and less expensive. In fact, back in 1837, a young Army lieutenant had surveyed the Rock Island Rapids, the stretch of river between Davenport and LeClaire, Iowa, and identified several possible bridge routes across the island, one of which became the chosen site of the first Rock Island Bridge. The man who surveyed those routes was Robert E. Lee. The path chosen for crossing the island precisely followed the property line of the late Colonel Davenport's estate, with the piers on the Iowa side of the island just 100 yards from his house. It's likely that he proposed this route, perhaps even at that first meeting, in anticipation of the potential economic benefit to himself. As I mentioned, the bridge plan advanced in three stages: across Sylvan Slough from Illinois to the island, across the island, and over the main channel into Iowa. The company used two contractors for this. The local John Warner Company oversaw pier construction and the island route. Chicago firm Stone and Boomer built the spans, with the main bridge using crisscross Howe truss-type construction. It was designed with five fixed spans and one draw span, and used more than 1 million feet of lumber and 600,000 pounds of iron. The main bridge was 1,580 feet long and 30 feet high, while the Sylvan Slough Bridge was 450 feet long. Early plans included a roof, but this was rejected because of fears that sparks from a locomotive could potentially cause a fire. Total cost of the bridges and rail line across the island was $400,000, which is the equivalent of $15 million today. To protect the wood, two coats of white paint were applied to the bridge. Small boats could fit under any of the spans, but steamboats had to use the draw, which pivoted as a swing span, like the current bridge, to allow river traffic to pass through. At the time, it was the largest and heaviest draw span in the country. By April 1, 1856, the bridge was complete, officially becoming the first railroad bridge crossing the Mississippi River. Engineers then conducted weeks of safety inspections before allowing the bridge to open. The first train did not cross until dusk on April 21st. Even then, they only sent one locomotive, the Fort Des Moines, to test the bridge. With this trip a success, the first commercial train crossed that night without incident, hauling 10 cars of goods bound for Iowa City. Convinced that the structure was safe, the formal ribbon cutting took place the next day when three locomotives hauled eight passenger cars from Rock Island to Davenport. Cheering crowds lined the tracks while church bells rang on both sides of the river. The newspapers of the day hailed the event. The Chicago Press remarked that bridging the Mississippi River represented a revolutionary step for science, like Caesar crossing the Rubicon, saying, quote, "The mission of Caesar of old was to conquer, so that of the Caesar of the 19th century. But the latter is one of peace and plenty. The war horse of civilization may have fiery nostrils, but it has an olive branch, the seeds from which it scatters as it flies, unquote. The Chicago Press also carried the apocryphal story of a carpetbagger supposedly riding the first passenger train. Though bound for the Western Plains, the story claimed, the man, once he'd crossed the Mississippi River via train, supposedly remarked, "This is enough glory for one day," and chose to settle in Davenport. Not everyone appreciated this achievement. A Memphis, Tennessee newspaper, for example, lamented that the first railroad bridge spanning the Mississippi River had been built in Rock Island rather than Memphis, Vicksburg, or New Orleans, declaring, quote, "The North has beaten the South in establishing a means of better trade and commerce directly to the expanding American West," unquote. It was everything Southern business interests had feared. The people of central Iowa could now reach New York City in 2 days, while Texans comparatively dwelt in a wilderness. Despite these local celebrations, all was not well with the bridge. One problem was the placement of the draw span, which did not precisely line up with the main channel, forcing boats to shift left or right in order to make it through the draw. The construction technique was also a problem. How truss bridges, though popular, were not particularly safe. They tended to wear out quickly, with heavy trains causing some to collapse, and hot coals from locomotives also set fire to structures. The biggest problem facing the bridge was the hostility of the river interests, which would lead to a noteworthy disaster. At 230 feet long, the steamboat Effie Afton was the fastest sidewheeler of its size on the Ohio River. It had an established route between Louisville, Kentucky, and New Orleans, Louisiana, and in 9 months of operation, it had never traveled on the northern Mississippi River. However, the day after the Rock Island Bridge opened for business, the Effie Afton steamed north, with no reported cargo, no declared destination, and with insurance adjusted to cover fire only. On May 5, 1856, less than 2 weeks after the bridge opened, the Effie Afton reached Rock Island and moored downstream of the bridge. The pilot reportedly spent time ashore part of the next day. Then, that evening, the Effie Afton moved into the main channel and headed upstream, only to collide with a ferry boat, receiving minor damage. After that, the pilot challenged another boat to a race. Finally, Effie Afton blew her whistle to signal the bridge crew. The draw span opened, and the bridge successfully passed through the draw. Then 200 feet upstream, the Effie Afton's side paddle wheel stopped, causing the steamboat to float downstream, where it slammed into first one and then another pier, damaging both the boat and the bridge. According to the crew, a stove overturned on board, resulting in a fire that burned the boat down to the waterline within 5 minutes and then spread to the bridge. As the bridge burned, its draw span crashed into the river, at which point nearby steamboats sounded bells and whistles in celebration, while smaller boats swooped in to rescue the crew of the Effie Afton. The boat's wreckage eventually broke free of the bridge and floated 3/4 of a mile downstream, where it promptly sank. By the time volunteer fire crews put out the fire, the draw span was a complete loss, and the spans on either side of the draw were significantly damaged. It would be 4 months before repairs to the bridge were complete. This incident spurred another round of courtroom battles over the Rock Island Bridge, resulting in a series of cases that would ultimately settle the issue over whether steamboats and railroads had equal right-of-way. The immediate issue was one of blame. The owners of the Effie Afton blamed the bridge company for creating an obstruction, while the railroad blamed pilot error for the accident. Backed by the St. Louis Chamber of Commerce, the owners of the Effie Afton sued the bridge company, asking $65,000 in compensation and demanding the removal of the bridge as an illegal obstruction to navigation. Chicago business interests saw the suit as evidence of a conspiracy against the railroad industry, claiming the crash had been a premeditated act. Heard et al. Versus the Railroad Bridge Company began in September 1857, in front of the same Judge McLean who had previously ruled in favor of the railroad. The result of this case would impact not only the future of railroads in the United States, but the career of one of the lawyers representing the railroad, Abraham Lincoln. The Chicago papers promised thorough coverage of the trial, framing it as, quote, a fundamental national struggle in desperate need of resolution, unquote. Lincoln was hired due to his work on behalf of the Illinois Central Railroad, as well as for his demeanor, which the railroad directors believed would appeal to an Illinois jury. Throughout the trial, newspapers in Chicago and St. Louis stirred the pot. For instance, the St. Louis Republican declared, quote, the railroad bridge at Rock Island is an intolerable nuisance. It is utterly impossible for any man, not an idiot, to note the disasters at Rock Island and honestly ascribe them to any other cause than the huge obstruction to navigation which the bridge company have built there and insist shall remain, even though lives by the score and property by the millions are destroyed every year. We have rarely seen such illustration of supercilious insolence as have been presented by advocates of the bridge, unquote. The Chicago Tribune countered, quote, facts do not warrant the incessant clamor kept up by those who insist that magnificent and necessary structure shall be torn down. We trust that the outcries of the St. Louis and River Press may be silenced, unquote. Representing Heard and the steamboat interests were Hezekiah Weed, Corydon Beckwith, and Timothy Lincoln, no relation. The plaintiffs conceded that railroads had the right to expand, and even suggested they would not object to a properly built bridge. However, Weed argued the Rock Island Bridge was no such structure, and the bridge company had violated their charter, under which they had promised to erect a bridge, quote, in such a manner as shall not materially obstruct or interfere with the free navigation of said river, unquote. They claimed that many steamboats since the Effie Afton incident had also struck the Rock Island Bridge. Weed argued that, while an impressive feat of engineering, the bridge had not been constructed in line with the main channel, where the current was strongest, thus forcing boats into the piers. In short, Weed stated, the bridge company, without knowledge of the river, had placed their bridge where they liked, with no thought to safety. He then deposed over 50 riverboatmen to testify to the dangers of the bridge. Each referred to it as a material obstruction, which created cross currents and eddies sufficient to imperil the Effie Afton and every other craft on the waters. All agreed that the river sped up in the vicinity of the piers, though not on that rate of increase. Some said the current was 6 miles an hour, others said 12. All admitted they were estimating according to their experience. Whatever the speed, the consensus of the plaintiff's witnesses was that the bridge was hazardous, posing dangers so great that one river pilot claimed he would not pass the bridge until, quote, I took my money and other valuables on my person to be ready for any trouble, unquote. Another pilot claimed that passengers were so alarmed by the dangers of the bridge that they would not travel through the draw, but preferred to disembark, walk around the bridge, and board again on the other side. They also claimed insurance companies had started raising rates based on the bridge hazard. The plaintiffs rested their case, opening the door for a defense team which was well prepared. Representing the Rock Island Bridge Company were Norman Judd, Joseph Knox, and Abraham Lincoln. The key would be Lincoln, who personally traveled to Rock Island to inspect the bridge and measure the river's currents himself. Now, I should say as a side note, the story of Lincoln's trip to Rock Island has long been considered apocryphal in the Quad Cities, possibly because his own colleagues kept the story out of their memoirs later in life, mostly it seems to enhance their own roles in the case. However, Lincoln's correspondence shows that he did, in fact, travel to Rock Island on the 1st of September, 1857, before the commencement of the trial. According to papers of the time, for which there are no other corresponding sources, Lincoln met a 12-year-old boy, possibly the son of a bridge engineer, who was fishing from the repaired structure. Lincoln supposedly quizzed the boy about river currents, and then the two embarked upon a series of experiments involving throwing floating objects into the river to time the speed and direction of the current. Based on his arguments in trial, it is clear Lincoln was familiar with the bridge's construction and the current at the draw. Armed with this research, the defense declared that the plaintiff's counsel was, quote, entirely mistaken in his statement of the facts, unquote. By contrast, the defense came armed with statistics, scientific tests, and observations from local residents. One of the first defense witnesses was Seth Gurney, caretaker of the bridge. He produced a logbook showing that in the year after the bridge repair, 958 boats had passed through the draw safely, while only 7 hit the piers. Based on these facts, Knox mused that if getting past the bridge was a result of luck rather than skill, then those 958 pilots must be the luckiest men alive. He logically concluded that the low number of accidents was not the result of luck, rather the accidents were the result of incompetence and neglect. The bridge, Knox asserted, was well constructed and sound, bringing in 6 engineers to prove it. Unlike the 3 engineers called by the plaintiffs, only one of whom had been to Rock Island, and then only when the river was frozen, every defense engineer had inspected the bridge and had conducted tests. They unanimously agreed that there was no significant cross current endangering river traffic. To back up the engineers, the defense provided anecdotal testimony from prominent citizens, including industrialist John Deere, the mayor of Rock Island, and the editor of the Rock Island Advertiser. All testified that no cross currents or eddies interfered with boat traffic. They further noted that boats or logs set adrift upstream unfailingly sailed through the draw. These claims were further backed by models and maps. The defense concluded that the act was either the result of gross negligence or a deliberate act. Highlighting the negligence argument, the defense reminded the jury that the F.E. Afton had collided with another craft prior to passing through the draw and had engaged in a boat race, suggesting poor judgment on the part of her officers. Knox pointed squarely at pilot Nathan Parker, accusing him of recklessness. Mr. Judd then argued for the possibility of deliberate sabotage, noting how curious it was for an expensive steamboat to be insured only for fire. He then produced a witness who had overheard Captain Hurd remark following the collision, quote, "It is a pity she don't burn. She's good for nothing. I would burn her and get the insurance," unquote. After which the fire mysteriously erupted. Knox concluded by asserting that the bridge was not an obstacle, but rather an improvement that had benefited the entire country. Then Lincoln started his closing, which would take 2 days. Lincoln acknowledged the joys of river travel, saying he understood the viewpoint of rivermen and didn't blame them for defending their enterprise. Yet, he argued, railroads had just as much right to travel east and west as riverboats had to travel north and south. He pointed out that while rivers froze over and were unusable for 4 months per year, the Rock Island Bridge had served people year-round, carrying more than 12,000 freight cars and 74,000 passengers in the year following the accident. He dismissed arguments that the bridge was poorly placed, reiterating that the accident had everything to do with the pilot and nothing to do with the bridge. As reported by the Chicago Daily Press, Lincoln, referring to the incompetence of the pilot, asserted, quote, "The Afton came there on the 5th and lay at Rock Island until the next morning. When a boat lies up, the pilot has a holiday, and would not any of these jurors have then gone round the bridge and gotten acquainted with the place? Pilot Parker has shown here that he does not understand the draw. I heard him say that the fall from the head to the foot of the pier was 4 feet. He needs information. He could have gone there that day and seen there was no such fall." Unquote. After 14 days of argument and testimony, the issue went to the jury. Judge McLean, in his instructions, said the case turned on one issue. Was the bridge a material obstruction to river traffic? The jury deliberated for a few hours, then reported that they were hopelessly deadlocked, 9-3 in favor of the bridge. The judge dismissed the case, giving the railroad a win by default. Rather than quiet the riverboat interests, the non-decision merely convinced them they could not trust Chicago courts. agitation from St. Louis and New Orleans led to the formation of a congressional committee to investigate the Rock Island Bridge situation. This committee concluded that the bridge was a hazard, but declined to act, indicating their preference for the courts to settle the issue. The river interests were happy to oblige. In May 1858, led by steamboat operator James Ward, a St. Louis group filed suit against the Mississippi and Missouri Company, demanding removal of the bridge. They chose to sue the M&M because it was an Iowa-based company, which allowed them to file suit in the southern Iowa district located in the river town of Keokuk, Iowa. Judge John M. Love scheduled a hearing for September 1859, giving both sides ample time to flood the court with their affidavits. Meanwhile, in June 1859, a group of unknown persons attempted to take matters into their own hands. In the middle of the night, they placed a large quantity of combustibles, consisting of sulfur, tar, turpentine, saltpeter, and oil, on one of the spans of the Rock Island Bridge. But before they could light the materials, a watchman spotted them and chased them off. These culprits were never identified. The final hearing of James Ward et al. Versus Mississippi and Missouri Railroad Company took place in November 1859, with Keokuk attorney Samuel F. Miller appearing on behalf of the riverboat interests. Judge Love ruled in April 1860 in favor of the plaintiffs, declaring the bridge a public nuisance and ordering the removal of all spans deemed to be on the Iowa side of the channel. The railroad company immediately appealed the decision to the Supreme Court, thus delaying immediate action against the bridge. Angered at the slow pace of justice, the city of New Orleans raised the sum of $50,000 to assist St. Louis in any efforts to tear down the bridge. The case of Mississippi and Missouri Railroad Company versus Ward reached the Supreme Court in December 1862. By then, Abraham Lincoln was president of the United States, and Samuel Miller, the riverman's attorney, was a Supreme Court justice. Miller accordingly recused himself from hearing the case. In its decision, issued on January 30, 1863, the High Court overturned the lower court's decision, ordering the bridge to remain in place. Judge John Catron, writing for the majority, argued the bridge did not interfere with navigation, and in any case, it made no sense to remove the Iowa side spans, as the issue was with the draw, which was on the Illinois side of the channel. Catron reiterated Lincoln's earlier point that east-west travel was just as valid as north-south travel, and stated, quote, "This bridge must be treated with respect in this court and is not to be kicked with contempt," unquote. Steamboat companies had lost another round, but still refused to give in. In 1866, the Supreme Court heard another case, the Galena, Dubuque, Dunleith, and Minnesota Packet Company versus the Rock Island Bridge. The U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois had ruled in the favor of river interests over two vessels damaged by the Rock Island Bridge, ordering $70,000 in damages. Curiously, the steamboat Galena had, years earlier, been one of the boats celebrating the arrival of the railroad to Rock Island. The bridge company appealed this decision, and the lower court's order was vacated. But the bridge company asked the Supreme Court to render its judgment as well to stave off future lawsuits. So, on December 30, 1867, the court finally ruled that river interests did not have a monopoly on rivers, and that the bridge was not responsible for their damages. This decision affirmed the right of railroads to build bridges across navigable waterways all across the United States. Of course, by that time, several other bridges had already been built elsewhere. But in any case, the Rock Island Bridge would never again face litigation aimed at its destruction. Although the bridge was rebuilt 4 months after the Effie Afton disaster, various weaknesses soon became apparent. Within 3 years, the volume of traffic necessitated rebuilding the bridge. The first effort to do this took place in 1865. This consisted of placing stronger timbers around the existing works before carefully removing the old timbers. This allowed the company to strengthen the bridge without closing it to traffic. But no sooner was the bridge built then discussion turned toward replacing the bridge altogether. The federal government, having recently used the island as a camp for Confederate POWs during the Civil War, now planned to build an arsenal on the site. This required easy access to safe and reliable railways. In 1866, Brigadier General Thomas J. Rodman, commanding officer of the newly established Rock Island Arsenal, drafted a plan to move the rail lines and bridge closer to the west end of the island. His choice of location was determined by conducting extensive surveys of the river and its current. The U.S. government offered to share the cost of construction for the new bridge while taking over its maintenance and operation. The company agreed to this, and for them the timing could not have been better, because in 1868 a larger-than-usual ice floe crashed into the bridge, knocking the drawspan into the river. The third bridge, made of steel, opened at the new location in 1873. By this time, rail lines had gone all across Iowa, prompting the establishment of the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad. This new bridge was double-decked, with a rail line above and a road below. The bridge consisted of five stationary spans and draw, like before. It was 1,500 feet long, 32 feet tall, and 16 feet wide, with two narrow lanes for traffic on the lower level. At its peak, it served more than 300,000 pedestrians every year. Because the bridge was jointly used by the railroad and the federal government, and was next to the arsenal on the island, the structure came to be known as the Government Bridge or Arsenal Bridge, while the island became known as Arsenal Island. As the population of the region grew, the 1873 bridge proved no match for the rising volume of traffic, so another government bridge was constructed on the same spot at the cost of $300,000, opening in 1896. By that time, there were 30 railroad bridges crossing the Mississippi River between St. Louis and St. Paul alone. The 1896 structure, which was the fourth bridge built from Arsenal Island to Davenport, was 1,850 feet long. It was also wider than the previous bridge, accommodating two rail lines, as well as vehicular, pedestrian, and streetcar traffic. Those streetcars would run all the way until 1940. This is the bridge still used by residents of the Quad Cities and workers on the Rock Island Arsenal to this day. It might be the world's oldest operational swing span bridge. As a final footnote, I'd like to relate an incident that occurred on a day in early spring in the late 1890s. On this occasion, a large sheet of river ice got hung up downstream of the government bridge, blocking early season barge traffic. To fix the problem, Captain Walter Blair used his ferryboat, the J.W. Robinson, to repeatedly ram the ice in an effort to break it up. After an hour of work, the sheet did break into manageable pieces and floated downstream. With this impediment out of the way, a team searched the river to discover and hopefully eliminate whatever had impeded the ice, creating a dangerous obstruction for river traffic. What they found, of course, was the remains of the Effie Afton. Thank you for listening to this inaugural episode of the Bulletin History Podcast, a product of the Public and Congressional Affairs Office of the U.S. Army Joint Munitions Command. We hope you enjoyed this story and look forward to more. It is our intention to present new episodes about once per quarter, as time permits, so we hope you come back for that. Until then, we're history.